Welcome to the Skinny Podcast, where we talk all things dermatology. I'm Carol Nicotero Ward.
And I'm Terry Rudd.
Before we get started, we want to let you know that our monthly podcast is available on iTunes. Search for us using the keywords The Skinny, Dermatology, and subscribe for free. Now on to the news. In this month's program, we'll hear about why many college athletes don't wear sunscreen.
An expert explains the do's and don'ts of recommending extra vitamin D.
And we'll talk about the growing body of evidence for using propranolol as a first-line treatment for hemangiomas.
Then cosmetic counter host Dr. Lily Talakoub takes a look at over-the-counter dermatology devices.
And Dr. Alan Rockoff talks about a cell phone camera as an alternative to the symptom diary. We begin with a look at the health habits of college students. A survey of NCAA athletes shows that almost half don't use sunscreen. And for dermatologists, that's cause for concern. Nassim Miller has more.
Dr. Ashley Weisong is a former six-time NCAA All-American and national champion middle distance runner. So she knows a thing or two about athletes' sun exposure. And now that she's a dermatology resident, she's concerned.
So we did a bi-coastal anonymous survey study of approximately 290 NCAA Division I athletes, really to get at what are the predictors and what are the barriers to sunscreen use in this really high-risk population. We really looked to quantify their overall sun exposure, which was one of the most shocking things, to be honest. So we found that our average NCAA athlete spent over 4 hours per day and greater than 10 months per year outside during peak hours of sun exposure, which is really just a very, very high number. And we see patients with lots of sun exposure over time, but these are, you know, young adults, young athletes from ages 18 to 22, and this is just a really high-risk time. So, you know, in addition to the increased exposure, we found that 84% of our athletes had experienced a sunburn in the last year alone, with over a quarter of those having four or more sunburns in the last year, and 10% having blistering sunburns. You know, as every dermatologist knows, you know, blistering sunburns, particularly in this younger age, have been correlated with melanoma long-term.
Dr. Weisong and her colleagues also found some predictors of who uses sunscreens and why.
We found that of female athletes, that gender was really very important, and female athletes were more likely to use sunscreen than male athletes. We also found that being on the West Coast location, so we did a survey study of West Coast athletes as well as East Coast athletes, and then we also found that this perceived risk of being at higher risk for skin cancer also significantly predicted whether or not athletes use sunscreen.
She had this advice for dermatologists.
You know, honestly, I think this is an underserved population. These 18 to 22-year-old athletes, they're very high risk. There's over 400,000 NCAA athletes. They're in all of our communities. You know, in addition to helping and intervening in these athletes, you know, NCAA and elite athletes serve as role models for young children. And, you know, we heard from our Assistant Surgeon General during this ASDS meeting the importance of outreach in these younger ages as well. And I really think by getting out and into your communities, talking to your NCAA athletes, getting involved as a dermatologist can only help with this population.
In other prevention news, it seems that every week there's a new study about the benefits of vitamin D. Our reporter Heidi Spleet clears up some of the questions about how patients can get it easily and safely.
Dr. Sheila Friedlander of the University of California, San Diego, explains why vitamin D supplementation is a more sensible option than sunbathing or filling up on salmon and shiitake mushrooms.
When you look at the Institute of Medicine's advice, if you look at the American Board of Dermatology, most groups feel it's a good idea. They don't make it absolute. So if someone is living on salmon and drinking a gallon of milk a day that's fortified, they probably don't need it. But the sense is, it's probably a good idea for everyone to be supplemented. Most people feel that vitamin D3 is better absorbed and has a longer shelf life. So most people will recommend that you supplement with vitamin D3. It's a case of a little, not enough. Some is good and a lot more could be bad. Unfortunately, initially people thought that there was lots of evidence for vitamin D to be supportive and protective for cardiovascular disease, for multiple sclerosis, for many forms of cancer, including pancreatic, breast cancer, perhaps even malignant melanoma. The problem is that there are conflicting studies. None of the studies are perfectly precise, perfectly conclusive, except for bone health. We know absolutely that vitamin D is crucial for good bone health.
But what about getting vitamin D from the sun? Dr. Friedlander emphasizes how relying on sunlight for adequate vitamin D puts anyone at risk for skin cancer.
There's a precursor to vitamin D in the skin, which is converted in the presence of sunlight. The problem is that the same spectrum of the sun that leads to that conversion for vitamin D also leads to sun damage and sunburn. So if you tell kids to go out in the sun for that reason, you're also putting them at risk for sunburn and skin damage. And it is known that sunlight's a carcinogen. So that is not the recommendation of the American Board of Derm or the American Board of Pediatrics. The recommendation is you never tell patients to go out into sunlight to get their vitamin D. Now, we'll all get a little bit of vitamin D production from incidental or incident sunlight. Even if we use sunscreen, you're still going to get a little bit. But you shouldn't think of that as the way to boost your vitamin D level.
On the treatment side, evidence continues to build for using the beta blocker propranolol for treating hemangiomas. Our reporter Jeff Evans has the details.
Systemic corticosteroids have long been the gold standard treatment for infantile hemangiomas, but recent reports suggest that beta blockers such as propranolol may be more effective in clearing the lesions. Dr. Ilona Frieden is the director of pediatric dermatology at the University of California, San Francisco. She described the state of research on this emerging treatment.
More than 150 articles have been written attesting to their efficacy, some showing possible cautions about side effects such as hypoglycemia. But what we do know is that they can be a remarkably effective treatment in shrinking hemangioma growth, even in children whose hemangiomas are already fully grown in some cases.
Interest in propranolol increased after a 2008 letter to the New England Journal of Medicine described its efficacy as a systemic treatment for hemangiomas. A recent randomized placebo-controlled trial found that the drug significantly reduced the size and number of hemangioma lesions. And now a large multinational trial of propranolol is underway. But despite the promising research on beta blockers, Dr. Frieden said watchful waiting is still the best approach to managing many hemangiomas.
I think it's very important to realize in talking about these therapies, though, that not all hemangiomas need to be treated. And we know that the natural history is one of involution over time, and therefore only perhaps even a significant minority actually need intervention.
Dr. Frieden has been a consultant to Pierre Fabre Dermatology, which owns a patent for propranolol.
Now, on to cosmetic counter. These days, there are over-the-counter devices for hair removal, acne treatment, and for smoothing out those wrinkles. But are these devices safe and effective? Or are your patients better off spending the money in your office? Our contributor, Dr. Lily Talakoub, has the bottom line.
The evolution of beauty products at home has changed rapidly in the last decade. Everybody knows of laser hair removal, acne treatments, and anti-aging treatments. However, most people that don't want to go to their doctor's office for repeated treatments have opted to develop and purchase home devices that they can use in the comfort of their own home. The most popular at this point is home laser hair removal systems. There is FDA-approved laser hair removal systems that are based on the technology used about a decade ago in office procedures known as the diode laser. These laser hair devices can be used in fair skin, however, are actually dangerous to be used in black or very dark skin. Patients opt to use these devices because they are effective, however, require much greater amounts of treatment because the laser is not as strong as the ones that are used in the office. Other home devices that have been used are skin renewing lasers for anti-aging benefits. There are microdermabrasion kits that people can buy over the counter to help fluff the top layer of skin. There are anti-aging and anti-acne kits as well. The newest technology is a home blue light device for anti-acne. This delivers blue light within a 360 to 480 nanometer wavelength, which has been shown for years in office procedures to be anti-acne. These devices actually are safe. They can be used on the face, the chest, and the back, or any acne-prone areas. There are very minimal risks to using blue light devices on the face. There is other devices that have been popular, such as the Clarisonic or these microdermabrasion or the skin polishing kits, all of them are relatively effective. However, they should be used under the guidance of a dermatologist.
And now, from his office in Brookline, Massachusetts, Dr. Alan Rockoff shares the story of one man's overzealous use of his cell phone camera.
As we all know, technology makes life better every day. In the past, for instance, patients who wanted to torture us with lists of questions had to write them down. Now they can use handheld devices that let them add symptoms every time they think of a new one. That's what I call progress. Then, of course, there are cell phone cameras, which make it possible to photo anything, anytime, anywhere. In an auto accident, the camera can document the bent fender along with the guy who bent it. Cell phone cameras can come in handy in dermatology, too. Patients whose rashes come and go, the ones who sigh that, oh, we should have seen the rash yesterday, can now photograph the skin problem at its worst. Improved resolution can make these pictures very helpful. But as with any other technological advance, it takes a really clever person to see a breakthrough everyone else missed. This happened in my office last week, when Ned came in with a history of vague-sounding complaints he said had stretched over a long time. Ned had tried to correlate his symptoms with what he ate, where he was, whom he met, and so on. In the old days, Ned would have needed to write a long symptom diary, like the ones I keep in my file to horrify students. But not anymore. "Doctor," he said, "I've used my cell phone camera to photograph my rash every morning at 10 a.m. for the past 7 months. Would you like to watch it as a slideshow?" I politely declined. I may take him up on it someday if they ever sentence me to solitary confinement. This is Dr. Alan Rockoff, signing off.
Well, that's all for now. We'd like to thank this month's contributing reporters, Jeff Evans and Heidi Spleet. This podcast has been produced by Nassim Miller and Mary Ellen Schneider, under the guidance of Skin and Allergy News Managing Editor Amy Pfeiffer. I'm Terry Rudd.
And I'm Carol Nicotero Ward. For more news and information, visit us online at skinandallergynews.com. And don't forget that we're on iTunes. So search for the Skinny, Dermatology and subscribe for free.